I guess we'll get started. It's a great pleasure to introduce
Dr. Robert Platt. Robert's an investigator at the center and a professor in pediatrics and epidemiology and biostatistics at McGill. He got his PhD in biostatistics from the University of Washington back in
1996
and has been at McGill since. He's also the methods lead for CNOS, the Canadian Network of Observational Drug Effect Studies. And his research interests include statistical methods in epidemiology with substantive emphasis on perinatal and reproductive epidemiology and pharmacoepidemiology. His talk is going to be issues in fitting marginal structural models.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you for the invitation as well. As I've said to Sammy Suisa on more than one occasion, I sit in many spots these days, but the reason I like to spend time here is because it's a good environment and there's lots of good environment, lots of fun, lots of good discussions going on. And so today I'm going to be telling you guys a little bit about, first of all, about marginal structural models, which are I guess this is showing my age there. I used to say they were a relatively recent tool added to the statistical toolkit in epidemiology, but they're getting older now. So they are a tool in the statistical toolkit for epidemiology. And with a number of colleagues over the last several years, I've done some work on some practical aspects of fitting marginal structural models. And I'm going to outline some of the things that we worked on and talk about some ongoing research and some new results. Okay. So first of all, because I think it's probably a good idea, I'm going to give some background on what a marginal structural model is and why they're interesting. And then I'm going to talk about three projects that relate to how to fit a marginal structural model. First, I'm going to talk about fitting a weight model. Marginal structural models are typically fit using a weighted estimating procedure. And the weight model is closely linked to the propensity score, which many of us know about and use a lot. I'm going to talk about some of the things we found about what the best ways to fit that weight model are. Then I'm going to talk about something called time-modified confounding, and that's a lot of steps. The first thing I'm going to do is reintroduce what we mean by confounding, and then I'll talk about why confounding that changes over time, which is what we call time-modified confounding, is a particular problem. And then I'm going to talk about some recent work on information criteria for marginal structural models. Then this is looking at, we all use, or we often use in regression settings or model selection settings, things like the AIC or the BIC. Those are information criteria which help us decide what structure a model should have or which model structures better support the data. And so we've proposed one that can be used in marginal structural models. And I'll follow up with some conclusions. Okay. So this is probably background that 99% of you know, but I'll go through just quickly. I'm going to be talking a lot using directed acyclic graphs or causal diagrams today. A directed graph is just a set of variables and arrows. And the variables indicate variables that we're studying, and the arrows indicate causal relations. And they're directed. We always have arrows. This is a little different from path diagrams from the social sciences, and they're acyclic in that a variable can't loop back on itself. And I'll use this term throughout, causal diagrams, to refer to a causal structure for a problem. So this covers, we're assuming that if we have a causal diagram, that all of the variables that we need to assess a causal effect are in there. And I'm going to use what I don't know if this is a new term, a new definition of confounding for everybody, but I'm going to throughout use a definition of confounding as in that top line. That is, that confounding is present when there's a common cause of exposure and outcome. And it may be that we have a measured common cause of exposure and outcome, or it may be that we have a measured variable that serves as a proxy for a common cause of an exposure and outcome. And you know, we can think of lots of examples of confounding. There's lots of examples in pharmacoepidemiology of confounding by indication, where the sicker patients are most likely to be treated and the sicker patients are most likely to die. That underlying illness is the common cause of both the outcome, mortality, and the treatment. And in a simple setting, a regression analysis is fine to control for confounding. And we typically teach in introductory stats courses for epidemiologists how to do linear regression, logistic regression, log linear regression, or even things like Mantel-Hansel analyses to adjust for confounding, or Cox regression for survival models. Now, a problem occurs, and this is really sort of the first main discovery that Jamie Robbins made when thinking about causal models in epidemiology. When we have time-varying confounding, that is, the confounder changes over time, and it may cause us particular problems if the confounder is also an intermediate variable. And I'll give an example on the next slide of what I mean by this. Okay, these are examples of directed acyclic graphs or causal diagrams, and for now, oops, I'm going to stay over here. For now, all we need to think about is, let's start with graph A there. Variable Z is a confounder. Variable X is a treatment or exposure. Variable Y is an outcome. And the things in brackets are just times. So Z at time 0 affects Y at time 2. Z at time 0 affects X at time 0. So that is, by my definition, a classic confounder. It's a common cause of our treatment and our outcome. And we would adjust for it using a regression model or a Mantel-Hansel model or something like that. So that's graph A over there. I'd like to focus then on graph D, where we now have a more complicated problem. We have a treatment that's measured at time 0 and then again at time 1, and a confounding variable Z that's measured at time 0 and then again at time 1. And then we still have our outcome Y at the end. And if we look at Z at time 1, it's a confounder for X at time 1 because it matches what we see in figure A. So we would want to adjust for it in a regression model, and everything would be fine in terms of estimating the effect of X at time 1. On the other hand, though, Z at time 1 is an intermediate variable for X at time 0. It's caused by X at time 0, and then it affects the outcome. And the example where this got the most sort of traction, I think, early in the epidemiologic literature is in treatment of HIV, where your CD4 count is your Z, and your Y is some mortality at the end of the study or some outcome at the end of the study. Your CD4 count at time 0 affects whether you're treated or not, and then your treatment affects what happens to your CD4 count at time 1, which affects what happens to your treatment at time 1, and all of those affect the outcome. And if we were to adjust for CD4 count at time 1, Z1, we would capture the effect of X at time 1 because we adjust for confounding correctly, but we would completely mess up the effect of X0 because we'd be taking away the effect of X0 that comes through lowering your CD4 count at time 1 or treatment at time 0. And that's really where and why models like marginal structural models, which are the subject of today's talk, were developed. All right. Now, this is more complicated than it needs to be, and there is some math in this talk, but I'm going to try to talk around the math as much as I can. A marginal structural model, the red is really what we have to match. It's the marginal expectation, and in brackets you can say that's the average, as a function of time-varying exposure, as a function of predefined time-varying treatment plans. And the predefined we'll ignore for now, but time-varying treatment plans is important. And it's basically saying that if we have an exposure pattern, X of T with a bar over top of it, a history of exposure to time T, we're modeling in that first bullet this in words. The expected or average Y at time T if everyone in our study were to follow the treatment pattern X bar of T. So if we have a time-varying treatment, like antiretroviral therapy in AIDS patients, we can compute things like what's the expected survival at the end of study if everybody were to be on treatment all the time from time zero to the end, versus the expected survival at the end of study if nobody were on treatment from beginning to end. And if we study only people who are on treatment from beginning to end and study only people who are off treatment from beginning to end, it's pretty obvious that we get into a problem of confounding that's not as simple as just looking at them at the beginning, because somebody who's able to stay on treatment the whole time, it could mean one of two things. One, it could mean that they're very sick, so they're being treated very aggressively, but also it means that they're healthy enough to stay on the treatment and not fall off the treatment. They're not lost because their treatment is going poorly. So these are the kinds of things we can estimate using these models. If we think about, and we can think about complicated treatment patterns too, treat for a week, then stop, then treat for a week, then stop, then treat for a week, then stop. If we wanted to look at that pattern, we could say, well, what would happen if everybody were treated with that pattern? These are the kinds of things we can model with marginal structural models. Okay. So there's a no unmeasured confounding assumption, which we have to make in any observational setting. This is more complicated than it needs to be. Anybody who wants an explanation of the formal statistical statement there, we can talk about that after the seminar, perhaps. So no unmeasured confounding can be represented by that statistical statement. This other statement puts it in words in a way that I think makes us recognize what an imposition the no unmeasured confounding statement is. That is, treatment at time t is independent of potential outcomes, and I haven't really explained what potential outcomes are, given the history of treatment in covariates. Folding that down to even simpler language, it's as if we think of each treatment decision as being a random decision given the history up to that point. And that, when you put it that way, that sounds like a huge assumption. That is, that everybody who has the same character, among a group of people with the same characteristics, if 50% of them took the treatment and 50% didn't, it's as if those 50% were randomly assigned. And that's a really big assumption when we say it that way, but it's the same assumption as no unmeasured confounding that we make all the way along. So we need to make that assumption. These models, as we dig deeper into them, force us to make this assumption very explicit, but it's an assumption that we carry on everywhere. And then this second assumption, I'll state, but I'm not going to go into too much detail on it for now. All right. Now, this, I think, is the mathiest slide in the talk, and I will try to talk us through it carefully without making too much reference to the math. But more or less, Robbins showed that you can adjust for this complicated confounding by fitting a weighted regression model to the crude data, where you weight by this thing. And the weights actually should be the inverse of, I just realized that there should be weights equal to 1 over this probability. That is, the inverse probability of the treatment received given the history of treatment and covariates, and that Q is any function can be dropped from this. But we create this inverse weighted model based on the inverse of the probability of receiving the treatment that you actually received given your history. Now that right there, if we think about that for a second, that sounds like, and this is the flavor of the next big chunk of the talk, sounds a little bit like a propensity score. The propensity score, and those of us who were at the journal club yesterday where we were talking about propensity scores, propensity score is just one of these statements, but it's the probability of getting treated given your history up to that point. So we can make these statements about complicated treatment patterns if we fit a regression model using this complicated weighting setting that's based on something that looks like the propensity score. And there's a little statistical note about the convergence down there. I will leave that out for now. So the propensity score, I said, this is that statement looks like the propensity score. The propensity score in epidemiology refers to this, the probability that X equals 1, that a person is treated given their covariates, Z, where Z is a vector of covariates, and it dates back to Rosenbaum and Rubin in the 80s. And conditional on the propensity score, treatment is effectively randomized, and within strait of the propensity score, comparisons can be interpreted as a causal effect. And so if we look back just for 1 second at this slide here, these weights are just products of propensity score-like terms. Now, Peter Austin in 2006 and Alan Brookhart also in 2006 both sort of simultaneously showed that propensity scores, and we were talking again about this in the journal club yesterday, should use true confounders and true predictors of the outcome or prognostic variables, but predictors of the treatment unrelated to the outcome may introduce bias and or increased variance. So if you're building a propensity score model where you have Z up there, true common causes of exposure and outcome, true confounders, should always be included in that model. Predictors of the outcome, Y, and their Y is nowhere up in that first statement, predictors of the outcome should be included in that model, but predictors of the treatment alone that are unrelated to the outcome are not a good idea. They may introduce bias or variance. And this has been subsequently, I guess, Ian would point out that this was subsequently derived after those two papers in a more theoretical framework by Judea Pearl and his colleagues who work through the formal rules of directed graphs and causal diagrams. So this gives us some guidance on how to fit a propensity score. And since our weights are just a product of the propensity score terms, we decided to investigate whether the same principle applies to models for the probability of A or X in marginal structural models. And I just went the wrong way here. Okay. And not surprisingly, the same is true. True confounders are essential in the weight model. If they're not included in that weight model, you're going to get biased estimation. Predictors of the outcome, on the other hand, will improve your bias and help reduce your mean square error, so give you smaller confidence intervals that are closer to your true value. Adding predictors of treatment only, that is, variables that only affect the treatment but don't affect the outcome, increase the mean square error. And this makes sense in a way because of that experimental treatment assumption. And if I have time at the end, I'll talk a little bit more about that. It unnecessarily spreads out our data in a way that doesn't help us in terms of adjusting for confounding. It appears that this problem goes away as our sample size increases, but we have to get into sample sizes that are unrealistic from our epidemiologic perspective. Hundreds of thousands and millions of observations to make things work. And not surprisingly, this we did in a large simulation study. If you add variables that are noise, that is, are unrelated to everything, bad things happen. You get increased bias. If you omit confounders, you also get increased bias because, obviously, if you omit a confounder, you haven't satisfied the original assumption. Okay. So I want to talk about a third form of confounding, or third structure for confounding. So confounding occurs when there's a common cause of the exposure and the outcome. And we have a toolkit for that. Time-varying confounding, where the confounder is also an intermediate, I haven't explained why marginal structural models get around that problem, but they do. and we can take that as another session. Time varying confounding, where it's also an intermediate, we have to use special tools to get around that problem. Now I want to talk about a third thing, this so-called time-modified confounding. This is that the confounder to the outcome relationship changes over time, or the confounder to the exposure relationship changes over time. And you can think about this as effect modification or interaction between time and the confounder. And I'll give an example of this that I think makes sense. If I'm looking at those HIV patients. So I have patients with who are in a cohort being followed over time for HIV, and I ask them about their smoking and drug use at baseline. Their smoking and drug use at baseline may affect what they do for treatment right at the beginning, and it may affect their outcome either at the beginning or later on, because it may affect both of those things. So it's quite possible that it's a confounder. If I think about smoking and drug use at baseline and treatment 10 years from now, the effect of that smoking, the time at baseline versus the outcome 10 years from now, that's going to be much weaker, because your behaviors change. Maybe you adopted healthier behaviors. Maybe you adopted worse behaviors, whatever. It's less likely that your behavior at baseline maps well to your outcome 10 years later. So the passing of time modifies the effect of that confounder on the outcome in this case. And here I give, this is back to my set of graphs here. Any number of these represent time-modified confounding. Here's graph number C there. Graph C there is clearly not time-modified confounding. The effect of Z0 has an effect on Y2, an effect on X0. Z1 has an effect on X1 and Y2. Down here, though, in graph F, Z0 has an effect only on Y2, but not on X0. And Z1 has an effect on X1, but not on Y2. So the confounding is present here, but it's not present here. It wasn't present in the first spot, and then it is present in the second spot. Figure E is just the reverse of that. It's present for the X0, but is not present for X1. And I had said this, I had mentioned that the weights are this product of propensity score-like things. And the simple question one can ask about this is, should those weights be the same propensity score-like thing over time, or should it be something that changes over time? And I think the logic is pretty obvious that if the confounding is changing over time, the propensity score-like thing that goes into these weights should change over time. And we showed, both in simulations and some examples, that this occurred. So we simulated data according to figure 1C, where there's no effect and confounding, 1D, where there is an effect and there's time-varying confounding, and 1E, where there's time-modified confounding. And the results are not surprising, I'd say, that the marginal structural model, I guess I should start from scratch here. When there's no effect and there's no time-varying confounding, the crude model is wrong, not surprising, because there is confounding, it's just not time-varying. But any method of adjustment, whether it be a regression model or the marginal structural model that ignores this sequential problem, or the marginal structural model that includes this sequential problem, all of them give an odds ratio on average that's right. It's right at 1. And 95% coverage probability, that's about 95%. And just a reminder, when we talk about coverage probability in statistics, the confidence interval has this funny definition that we never really use properly, that says that if the experiment were repeated many, many, many times. In the long run, the 95% confidence interval should include the true value 95% of the time. Here, since we've done it by simulation, we know that we can get to that long run, and we know that on average, something's doing well if it covers the true value 95% of the time, because we know what the truth is, because we simulated the truth. So all that's to say that in the simple case, any method works, and our confidence limit coverage work. Figure 1D, where there's the time-varying confounding, the adjusted model gets it very wrong. It gets us back to an odds ratio of 1. The standard marginal structure model and the proposed marginal structure model give us values that are close to the causal odds ratio. There is a small sample bias in there that statisticians might be interested in knowing about. There was some other work where we looked at quantifying that bias, but that's expected, that 1.39 versus 1.35, and the coverage probabilities are about right. And then if we do the time-modified confounding setting, well, not surprisingly, the time-modified confounding marginal structural model is the only one that gets close to the correct answer with the right coverage probability. So if we have all this to say, if we have a time-varying problem, we have to think carefully about both getting these propensity score, getting the form of the model right, but then getting these propensity score-like things that go into the weight models right at every step. And we need to think about how the confounding might change over time. The simple example of the HIV setting is one. I'm going to give another one in an example from my other work. For years I have spent my time and my work in reproductive and perinatal epidemiology, and a lot of it has had to do with this PROBIT study. The PROBIT stands for Promotion of Breastfeeding Intervention Trial. That study details there just reverses that. It's a randomized trial of a promotion of breastfeeding intervention. And actually, Stan was one of the initial investigators on PROBIT, and I think it's now going into its third or fourth wave of data collection, led now by people in the UK. So it's taking on a life of its own a little bit, the study. The ITT analysis in PROBIT models the effect of the intervention itself, which was this promotion intervention. So it tells you, if I go into hospitals and give encouragement to breastfeeding, to breastfeed, what happens to the outcomes? And we decided to try to look at the effect of breastfeeding itself in PROBIT. So we fit a marginal structural model, and the outcome is weight at 12 months. The exposure here now is breastfeeding to K months. So if we go back to what I said at the beginning, R12, for example, is breastfeeding at 12 months. So beta 12 compares or gives us an estimate of what would happen to our outcome, weight, at 12 months if everybody were to breastfeed for 12 months versus if nobody were to breastfeed for 12 months or if everybody were to wean within 1 month. And that's a very different thing than the intent to treat estimate with regard to the randomized intervention, but this is of sort of biological causal interest. So we have, again, we need this propensity score-like tool to build our weight model, and we need to select the variables for that propensity score model. So we try to build in the confounders, we try to build in the predictors of the outcome, and we had a long discussion about the intervention, whether we included the intervention in our marginal structural model variables. On the one hand, I told you earlier, we should not include variables that predict the treatment only. And the intervention, it sounds like, ought to predict breastfeeding only. But we had a long argument about whether the intervention, the promotion intervention, could increase the outcome through ways that didn't go through breastfeeding. That is, it could actually be a confounder of the breastfeeding association. So for now, it's plausible and we left it in. I think that's a good discussion as well. Here's though this subset of the models and a subset of the variables for this propensity score like tool that we use to weight the estimating equation. So this is I'll look at 1 month and 12 months. This is a model for the propensity to breastfeed past 1 month. So really it's for the propensity to stop breastfeeding at 1 month. And it is a model for the propensity to breastfeed past 1 month. So smoking is a good example. The odds ratio for smoking is 0.5, saying that if you were to past smokers were half as likely to continue breastfeeding. This is roughly using the odds ratio for the relative risk. They had a half the odds of continuing to breastfeed as did non-smokers, and that's not surprising. I think that's evidence from lots of studies that's plausible. On the other hand, past smoking has almost no influence on whether you continue to breastfeed at 12 months or not. And this makes some sense too, because imagine if you're a smoker and you've made it through breastfeeding to 9 months, the fact that you were a smoker at baseline or are a continuing smoker, you're probably a pretty committed breastfeeder at that point. You're probably not likely to use smoking as a decision to stop or not, or smoking as a corollary of socioeconomic factors to stop or not. It's probably not an influence on whether you breastfeed past 12 months or not. And in fact, most of the variables have very little effect on breastfeeding at 12 months. The intervention, in fact, has a strong effect on continued breastfeeding early on, a much weaker effect as time goes on. And that's if we look at the propensity to breastfeed over time. If we ignore the time and just look at the same model for all time points, we get a model that, not surprisingly, is somewhere in between, that says past smoking is preventative of continued breastfeeding, and the intervention is increases continued breastfeeding, but they're sort of in between the values. This 0.65 is in between these values. So it makes much more sense to fit our weights using those values than those. And now the results are not that exciting. The weights are, the beta 12s are pretty close to each other. From a clinical perspective, they're basically zero. They're 0.1 kilo versus negative 0.1 kilo. But on the other hand, the difference between the two is reasonably substantial. The confidence intervals almost don't overlap. And more importantly than all this, both of these contradict the observational results that we presented elsewhere, in which breastfeeding is associated with substantially lower weight. This suggests that breastfeeding really doesn't have much impact on weight over the course of the year. Okay. Lastly now, I need... unfortunately, I was wrong. I need to do a little more math here, and I think I want to skip this slide. I didn't realize I had taken this slide out. I left this slide in. The bottom line, though, with this information criterion, and I'm going to talk around this slide before I get to I'll come to this one. So we're interested in estimating this conditional expectation of a counterfactual random variable. And I apologize, I didn't define counterfactual random variables at the beginning of the talk. But we're interested in talking about these things here that are similar to what I said at the beginning. What would happen if we could assign everybody to a value of x1 and everybody to a value of x2? And given their covariates, what would happen to their outcome y? And the bottom line here is the question we want to answer. When we do statistical models in general, we wrestle with questions that look like this. We have this on the one hand, this is what we want to know, and this is on the other side. We have a regression model, or we have some covariates, we have variables. We have to think about what we want to put into the model. And so we think about the expected value of the outcome given covariates, and we might have multiple choices for this model here. And the question is, can we decide on an information criterion? And an information criterion is some measure of which model, which proposed model fits the data better, which of our models fits the data better than the others. And I'll put this in concrete terms in an example in a second. And I really don't want to go into this in too much detail. The bottom line is we can build one based on the observed data that does more or less what we think it should do, a weighted version of the AIC, the one that we use all over the place. And we can prove, I'm not going to do it here, but we can prove that this is equivalent to one that is based on the, I'll call it the causal data, the partially unobserved data that we start with. Oops. That's straightforward to show this in simple settings. But I want to go into an example so this makes some more sense. This is one of the earlier uses of marginal structural models in the epi literature. These guys were looking at CD4 count as a function of antiretroviral therapy over time, and this is one of the examples we started with. We know that if we ignore the time-varying nature of antiretroviral therapy, we're going to get the wrong answer. And they fit a model with a piecewise linear function, and I'll explain what that means. I'll explain that on the next slide. They basically put a linear model for the first year and then a linear model after that. So they allowed the CD4 count as a function of treatment to have a break in it at 1 year. So it kind of goes up, and then it may go up like this, or it may flatten out differently at 1 year. And the question is that the best model for this problem? We often, when we're fitting ordinary regression models, think about that same question. What's the best model for this problem? This is entirely analogous here. So we fit a bunch of models, and we fit a flat model with just an intercept, that is saying the CD4 count is flat over time with increased treatment. We fit a model that says it's linear with time. We added a linear exposure, a curvilinear exposure, a two-part linear exposure, which is what they fit in their paper, and then what we call a saturated model, which is essentially letting the model do whatever it wants and fit as many parameters as we possibly can. And the QIC in this problem more or less tells us that we're indifferent between these three models. That is a linear exposure, a curvilinear exposure, and a two-part linear exposure. And I have realized I didn't bring the graph of this. Becomes fairly obvious from the graph that that's about right, that this helps us tell what the exposure to outcome relation looks like. All this to say that the modeling process for these models is a two-part process. One is with regard to the weights, and getting that weight model, which is like the propensity score right, is step one. Getting this part, which is like any other regression model, is step two, and we use different tools to get to the right answer for each of the two steps. So I think I will skip this slide other than just to say that this is some other work that we've done over time on marginal structural models, and this one as well. And I'll just finish with, again, some summaries, and I think I just said this one. In marginal structure models, we fit them with this inverse probability of treatment weighting. It's using a function of the propensity score to fit the model. And the rules that turn out to be true for the propensity score turn out to be true for the marginal structural model weights as well. True confounders, and the statement I used at the beginning I hope we'll stick with you, that if we think of true confounders as common causes of exposure and outcome, or proxies for that common cause, getting those right is essential, including risk factors or prognostic variables, that is, predictors of the outcome, that's sensible, and predictors of treatment that are not confounders should be excluded. And this suggests a caution against automated model selection, that is, throwing everything in a model and just letting things turn out. And we had a discussion yesterday about the high-dimensional propensity score, which is a form of automated model selection, because we don't want to favor prediction of treatment, because that'll actually give us the wrong answer based on the bullet before this. In the setting of time-modified confounding, we think of that weight model as, we can think of that weight model as modeling the propensity to take the treatment over time. And if the what goes into that propensity model at time zero is not the same as what goes in at time two or time three or time four, we need to change the model and we need to incorporate that in our marginal structural model. I didn't show this, but the good news is that even if we're not sure that that setting is true, if we do model it as if it was true, we don't do very poorly. Our efficiency is about the same. On the other hand, I did not give a formal definition of time-modified confounding because it's not at all straightforward, and we couldn't actually get it to satisfy ourselves. And in the paper that we wrote on this, we couldn't get it to satisfy ourselves and the reviewers before we agreed on the paper, so it's not an easy thing to define. This QIC, the tool for model selection, at least in our initial work, it seems like it may provide useful information. I think it may not be as good as we initially thought it was, but it does provide useful information. On the other hand, I guess this is the critical limitation of it. I had said marginal structural models involve this two steps. One, getting that weight model right. Two, getting the outcome model right. What we've done here looks at the outcome model assuming that we got the weight model right. And it never goes back and forth and checks, did we get the weight model right, and then go back and forth and back and forth. And there are better ways to do this that very few people seem to understand or use, or there may be better ways that very few people understand or use to address that issue, but that's not something that we addressed. And then this is future work. I want to just give a little advertisement for some of the work that Tibor in particular and Menglan as well are both working on or have worked on. One of the things that people ask in practice a lot about these kinds of models is, well, what are the power implications of these? You know, we know how to do a sample size calculation for a randomized trial. We know how to do a sample size calculation for a traditional observational study model. We don't know how to do one for these, and we're working on that with some of our CNODES colleagues right now. And then there are lots of other more complicated settings where we're experimenting with different approaches. One that I'll highlight is just this one here, targeted maximum likelihood, which is one of these tools to go back and forth between the weight model and the outcome model and try to jointly do the best to optimize the causal inference. And I will end there just with a little note to say that this has been some ongoing work funded by a lot of people. Mike Kramer is the PI of the Probit study and provided the Probit data to us for a lot of methodological explorations. And this long list of people, including Menglan, Tibor, and Peter Austin, who's one of the methods co-investigators on the CNODES project, have done a lot of work on this. So I will stop there, and if there are questions, I see Ian writing on a plate, so there probably are questions. I'll take them now. It's all up to you, Ian.
I don't understand the propensity score completely, but it struck me when you said that you're using odds ratios as risks. Would that make a difference? If you use the relative risk instead of odds ratios for your propensity score, and which is more valid if it does?
Well, I should have been more. I realized that was. I saw you. I realized I should be more clear there. In fact, what you use it for the propensity score is the output, the predicted probability from the model. So you can use a logistic model, you can use a log linear model, you can use a probit model if you want to. Sorry for the pun, but you can use all kinds of models that model a binary outcome, and you really only care about the predicted probability. We're just using the odds ratios or relative risk sort of as an illustration. And so that really doesn't matter. I should look at the relative risks, but it really doesn't matter in terms of getting the propensity score right. I thought you would also have something to say about the weak instruments or the weak confounders.
I was, except you said that there's no unmeasured confounder.
Right.
So you eliminated that question. But I did think of it.
It seems like when you use this for looking at who's going to get a treatment or who's going to shoot them going on, it seems it could have other applications. I mean, just coming from the psychosocial side of it, but people might feel like to say that, for instance, if your depression gets better, you'll live through your heart disease, and they have already missed the longevity. So that said, they're forgetting the fact that the chicken egg issue was, you know, the movement in, say, the cardiovascular symptoms over time. That could be the confounder, it's time varying.
Yeah.
That's actually driving, say, a status on the exposure to depression or whatever.
Yeah.
So it would seem that you could use this, and this model could explain gaps in other areas that aren't necessarily who gets treated, but who is exposed to something like that, too.
I think these kinds of problems have a lot of promise in a lot of fields. I think the reason that they get used a lot in a very treatment-centric setting is because, and that HIV example is a classic example, because the signals are so strong. If I look at this graph here, the graph that illustrates the HIV setting, say here, all of these arrows are really, really strong, and it's really, really obvious that if you start ART treatment, your CD4s are going to shoot right up, provided that everything else is okay, and that then the physician makes a decision primarily based on what happened to you here as to whether to keep treating or not. And we ran into this a little bit in the breastfeeding example. When you get into less sort of, when you get into things where the sort of the feedbacks are a little less sharp, the decisions get more fuzzy and the models get weaker. But I think, you know, we tried, there was a student a few years ago tried applying some of these in social epidemiology settings where you're thinking about, it was a very nice example of something like poverty and family structure over time. So, you know, is it the poverty or is it the marriage breaking up or is it some feedback loop between the two? But you need to have pretty sensitive data to study something like that.
Feels like that too. Is our data collection methods are weak, and
I would say all fields we could do better in our data collection processes. I mean, we've run into trying to do this. Michelle Wilczewski's not here, but trying to do this in using, you know, the sort of classical pharmacoepi data of RAMQ or CPRD, we still run into that problem with problems that are not as cut and dried as this one, just because the signals are not as strong. And you'd like to know, you know, every time they think about changing a statin prescription, what happens, but you don't necessarily get good enough data to do that.
Robert, can you take a step back and sort of give us sort of either an overview or your sense of, I mean, you know, this work for the past 20 years or so has been, you know, terribly intellectually exciting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really captivating. A lot of bright people doing a lot of interesting theoretical work. And I guess maybe for, I don't know, what would you say, the last decade, we started to see the evolution in terms of its use in practice.
Yeah.
My inkling is probably in social epidemiology, it's started to get a bit of a toehold.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what, like, because to me, looking at it from the context of trials, I, you know, when you start with, well, we have the right model, you know, It's like saying if people were of goodwill, we'd have world peace or something like that. But
you don't think so?
It's a big assumption. Do you see? I mean, let's go back to another stuff. You know, with Bayesian methods. You know, Bayesian. If you want to start from Reverend Thomas Bayes, or if you want to start from De Groot, you know, in the 60s or whatever, it took like a good 20 or 30 years, and then we got the software, and now, you know, that I'd say that's quite a bit further along than causal inference. But where the trajectories cross, I don't know. What's your sense? You know, or do you have a sense of where we are in terms of the evolution, you know, the ready for prime time in a variety of aspects?
First of all, I love your question, and I was just telling the students, I was teaching my causal inference course at McGill this morning, and we were starting to get into being explicit about all the assumptions that you have to make. We've been spending the last few weeks on all the assumptions you have to make a causal inference statement from an observational setting. And one of the students gave a complicated example, and I said, you know, it's situations like this that make me think I really should just stick to clinical trials because I know what's happening over there. We simplify the world such that but I think my thinking about how statistical tools get into the epidemiologic toolkit is that they start out in the nether reaches where only a few people know how to use them, and they start percolating, and then at some point they kind of shoot up, at which they become the tool in the if you have a hammer everything looks like a nail joke, and I think we're sort of at least in the micro world of SER, Society for Epidemiologic Research, epidemiology, we're somewhere in that uphill slope of, students and junior faculty and people everywhere are sort of going gangbusters trying to use these models, even though they're not necessarily the best tool for a specific problem. We're somewhere in there, and I think we're probably going to go further up and then drop down. Like, I mean, the best example of something like that I would give is the things like the multi-level models, random effect models, kinds of things that when I graduated from my PhD were sort of novel and a little bit weird kinds of things, but then MLWIN came out and a couple of procedures in SAS came out, and all of a sudden they were the hammer and everything is the nail. And I think with this we're going to have sort of an acceleration and then a settling down to sort of realize that they are very good in some settings, very important in some settings, very useful for other reasons that I didn't talk about today in other settings, but sort of almost as a diagnostic tool, but that they're not magic. And it comes back to a discussion we had about propensity scores yesterday. It was Christelle, is that right? Who said this, that if you have lousy variables and you fit a propensity score, you get a lousy result, even though you fit a propensity score. These are not magic tools, and there's sort of a rebound effect. And I think, I don't know where Bayesian methods stand on that timeline, but I think they've gone through, especially with the advent of the easy computation, a similar sort of trajectory. I still think we need to spend more time thinking about what the right tool for the problem is before we use a tool.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.